Is Psalm 83 a prophecy about an end-time war between Israel and its neighbors, or is it something else? Is Psalm 83 a prophecy about an end-time war that could occur any moment, or is it describing something else? I contacted Bill Salas and his major critic, Tommy Ice, and asked if they would appear on this program and present their arguments, and both graciously agreed to do so. We are going to begin with Tommy Ice presenting his objections to Bill's thesis, and then Bill will respond. Here now is Tommy Ice.
My problem with the Psalm 83 theory by Bill Salas is that Psalm 83, first of all, does not contain a prophecy. It's an individual lament psalm, a national lament by Asaph, and Asaph is complaining 3,000 years ago about the enemies that surround Israel. And I admit, when you read it, you'd think you're reading about the modern situation in Israel, which shows that in 3,000 years, things really haven't changed. It's a basic anti-Semitism. But in some of the lament psalms, like Psalm 79, for example, you have the Lord answering the request where he will give a prophecy, for example, about what he's going to do in response. In Psalm 83, you don't have the Lord answering it. And therefore, there's an assumption that there's going to be a battle behind this. And there may or may not be, but Psalm 83 does not contain a prophecy. It just contains the lament or complaint that Asaph is giving. Secondly, when you look at the parallel passages, well, they're not really parallel, but those that mention these nation, 10 nations that are people groups that are mentioned in Psalm 83, these are mentioned in the prophets later on. And if you want to look at the development of Old Testament prophecy in any detail relating to Israel, you have to start with the book of Deuteronomy, has an outline of prophecy, and you really don't have much prophecy being given until the prophets come in and they start fleshing out this. For example, you have Psalm 2, that is the psalm where it says, "Kiss the Son, lest he be angry. Why are the nations in an uproar?" etc., etc. Well, later on, when you learn the outline of Israel's prophecy, you realize that Psalm 2, which was given 3,000 years ago, fits into the idea of the tribulation. And these nations are, you know, going up against God, and he's going to judge them in the tribulation. Well, in the Old Testament, you have, I call them the synoptic prophets, just like you have synoptic gospels. Synoptic means the same. And you have Matthew, Mark, and Luke are similar, and John has like 93% difference in its gospel. And the same is true in the four major prophets. You have Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel. And each one of those prophets has a section relating to the judgment of the nations. And most of these nations or people groups that are mentioned in Psalm 83 are given, included in the judgment of the nations. For example, in Isaiah chapter 13 through 23, you have that section. You have a similar section in Jeremiah. I think it's 9 chapters long. You have another section in Ezekiel that's 7 chapters long, and they say a lot of the similar things. And the context of the judgment of the nations is going to be at Armageddon, basically. In other words, in conjunction with the tribulation. And so if there's going to be an actual fulfillment of Psalm 83, it's these other passages talk about the judgment of those people groups in conjunction with the second coming when he is going to judge the nations, because that's the very purpose. In fact, Isaiah 20, chapters 24 through 26 talks about the judgments of the nations, you know, basically for their rejection of God. And we learn from Revelation 3:10 that the tribulation's purpose is to test the earth dwellers. That phrase earth dwellers comes from Isaiah 24 and 26, where that's a term that's used 11 times in the book of Revelation, and these are the people who oppose God. And so this is the time in which those nations will be judged, and therefore I think that the idea that there's got to be a Psalm 83 war to set up the peace for Ezekiel 38 and 39 is just built on speculation. And the New Testament warns against speculation a number of times. Paul, especially in the pastoral epistles, says that this is something he warns us about. Now, we all speculate on Bible prophecy, but it's one thing to speculate within the framework of clear revelation, like this is the tribulation or this is the millennium and how are things going to work out, because those are settled among literal interpreters, you know, that there's going to be a 7-year tribulation or there's going to be a 1,000-year millennium. And, for example, today we see the European Union preparing the way, apparently, for the revived Roman Empire. We see Israel back in the land because there's dozens of passages that talk about them returning to the land. And we speculate within that framework. And even though I agree with Bill that Ezekiel 38:39, the Gog-Magog battle, will probably take place at the beginning or before the tribulation, in other words, shortly before that, because I believe there will be an interval of time between the rapture that ends the church age and the start of the tribulation, because it takes time for the Antichrist, who's being restrained by the church age, according to 2 Thessalonians 2, to get into place, to set up a 10-nation confederacy, and for him to arise from among that. So there's got to be a period of time after the rapture and before the tribulation starts, which starts as a result of Israel agreeing or them imposing a contract on them from that revived Roman Empire and by the beast or the Antichrist himself. So it's very likely that that's when that will take place. And so Bill speculates, because he doesn't give a Bible verse or passage to teach this, that there's going to be a war based on Psalm 83 with those immediate nations surrounding Israel to set up the peace, and Israel's going to win and all of this, and that will set up the basis for the Gog and Magog thing. Well, when you look at the end of chapter 39, I think it's around verse 28 and following, it talks about how the Lord has hidden himself from the nation of Israel. And that appears to refer to the period from the time of Christ to the tribulation period, because the Old Testament is focused on that 70th week of Daniel, the tribulation period. And so I think the battle of Gog and Magog has to be related to the tribulation period, because it's during that time that Israel is going to come to know Christ. And he's going to be vindicated from that. Before that time, it appears that God is not working directly or prophetically during the church age, because the church age is a time in which you have general trends or characteristics. You don't have specific prophecies that are occurring in the tribulation. And when the church age began in Acts 2, you did have some of Israel's prophecies that were fulfilled, like the destruction of Jerusalem that Jesus gave in Luke 19, and some of those as they transitioned into that. And apparently, as we transition out of the church age into the time of Israel, you're going to have things like Israel returning back to the land in a similar way. But these events that are talked about in the Old Testament, I believe, have to take place either in a near relation to the tribulation or in the tribulation itself. And that's why people who believe that things are going to happen during the church age are called historicists. And people who take it more literally believe in the 70th week of Daniel and all of this, that these events will happen in the future to the time of the church age. And I think that since there is no passage that actually teaches the belief that the Psalm 83 theory teaches, that it's pure speculation. And that's the rationale given in his book, Israel Stein, is that there needs to be something that happens that brings peace to set up the peace required in Ezekiel 38-39. So it's a speculation built upon a speculation. And yet, when I hear people on the radio or talk to friends who believe in Psalm 83 theory, they talk about it like it's going to be an actual event. And at best, it ought to be noted clearly that this is pure speculation. It is pure speculation because, as I say, there's no prophecy, you know, behind it, and there's nothing directly that relates to it.
Okay, you have heard Tommy Ice's objections to the idea that Psalm 83 is a prophecy about an end-time war that will precede the war of Gog and Magog. Let's hear now Bill Salas's response.
First of all, I highly recommend Tommy Ice as an excellent teacher when it comes to talking about the pre-trib rapture. Often we'll refer people to the pre-trib rapture website, and I think he's got a lot of outstanding work on that. And I do also agree with him that the Psalm 83 is a prayer of lament and an imprecatory prayer, that Asaph is calling upon the Lord to intervene, and he's beseeching him to deal with his adversaries. But where I think Thomas Ice falls short is seeing the prophetic aspects within the psalm. He thinks it's just a prayer of lament and not a prophecy. Well, let's start with this. 2 Chronicles 29:30, Hezekiah says that he commands the Levites to sing the praises of King David and Asaph, who's the author of the psalm, and he calls them a seer. The Hebrew word is clearly talking about a beholder of vision, a prophet. So Asaph wrote 12 psalms. Psalm 83 is one of the most prophetic of the psalms. He was a prophet. Now, Hezekiah would be very interested and would know that he was a prophet, because among the confederacy that Asaph talks about in Psalm 83 is a member called Assyria. Now, at the time that Asaph wrote, Assyria was not even in the picture. They weren't even really one of Israel's enemies until later. But they were an enemy of Hezekiah. They had come into the fray with Israel during Shalmaneser II around 850 B.C., and Hezekiah was around 701 B.C. So Assyria was already interacting with Israel problematically. They destroyed the northern kingdom of Israel in 722 B.C. So Hezekiah, around 701 B.C., had to deal with the Sennacherib issue with Assyria. So Hezekiah would be very concerned about what's going on with Assyria, and he would know that Asaph had spoken about Assyria in a prophecy. Another thing, when we talk about this prophecy, Asaph talks about, and I'm going to conclude by talking about the psalm and breaking it down as a prophecy. But among the confederacy that Asaph talks about, he talks about, includes a place called Gabal, along with Assyria. Now, Gabal, you don't even hear about them until Ezekiel 27. Ezekiel wrote long after Asaph. Asaph wrote about 1,000 years B.C. Ezekiel wrote, you know, about 500, 600 years B.C. So he wrote after. So it had to be a prophecy, because Asaph was not just saying, God, help us with these enemies around us. And he listed a very specific group of 10. And, of course, Israel had much more than 10 enemies up to that point in time. But he lists a specific 10. And so two of them weren't even in the fray at that point in time. So he was talking about a future scenario. Now, he also talks about them in a habitation condition. So he's talking about this confederacy, and he calls the very first member the tents of Edom. He's listing some population, some people group, in a habitation condition. Now, biblically speaking, that would be either military encampments or refugee crises, refugee conditions. The Edomites, descendants of Esau, have ethnical representation in the Palestinians today. I do believe what Esau was trying to tell us, it became a reality in 1948, that there would be a refugee crisis, a Palestinian refugee crisis, and they would be part of this overall problem And I think that finds its face in today. Now, also he says about Assyria, they actually helped the children of Lot. So you have a Confederate member that is assisting another Confederate member. The children of Lot would represent Jordan for the most part today. And at no time in Jordan's history did Assyria ever help Jordan until they were involved in wars in 1948 and 1967, and Jordan was not one of the stronger members in that war. So I think it's a prophecy from that perspective. Asaph was a prophet, but that's just one argument about it. One of the things that Dr. Rice talks about, which is a little bit disturbing to me, is that he says, when my friends speak about Psalm 83, or I hear radio interviews about Psalm 83, he says at best it should be said that this is just utter speculation. First of all, that ignores an enormous amount of research I've done through the years. And I wasn't the first one to write on Psalm 83. This was not my brainstorm of an idea or hypothesis. Mutually respected people like Dr. Ronald Fruchtenbaum first wrote about it in his book, The Footsteps of the Messiah. David Dolan wrote about it in his book, Israel in Crisis, before I even wrote about it and figured out for themselves. I do not believe that Psalm 83 has to precede the rapture. Now, it might. The rapture could happen before, it could happen during, or it could happen after Psalm 83. But I believe in the doctrine of imminence, as does Dr. Ice. I believe that we should be looking for the return of Jesus at any given moment. But I also see, watching the geopolitical situation in the Middle East, that Psalm 83 is also very imminent, and it could happen, and we need to be prepared for it. Now, I want to talk a little bit about the psalm. Asaph is petitioning God about a concern, a genocidal attempt of the Jewish people. He's saying that they're going to form a confederacy, they're going to have a plan, a contemporary confederacy of Arab states. These Arab states share common borders with Israel. That they're going to have a contemporary confederacy, they're going to have a plan to destroy the nation of Israel, that the name of Israel can be remembered no more, if that's a prophecy for our time. That means they don't want peace with the Jews today, the Arabs and the Palestinians. They want peace without the Jews. And they don't want a two-state solution. They want one more state, and they want to fly the flag of Palestine over it. And folks, I think this is a very real concern. It certainly is with Israel, and it should be a concern for you as supporters of Israel. He goes on to talk about the Confederacy, as I said to you. Now, Dr. Rice has made the comment that if this is a prophecy, how come it's not in the prophets? It's the major and minor prophets that start emphasizing prophecy. That the prophets did talk about that, and I point out about 150 verses that I think apply to the prophets addressing these very population groups, Edomites, Ammonites, Moabites, Gebal, Assyria, Ishmaelites, Hagarines, and I put maps in the book, of course, of who they are. The Arab states are in common borders with Israel. I call them an inner circle. Inside of that inner circle, you've got terrorist populations that have evolved, Hezbollah, Hamas, of course, you've got the Palestinians, etc. So I believe Asaph has spoken, and the other prophets, very much about them. The problem that Dr. Rice runs into is because he believes that it's in consistent futurism, that the judgment of all the nations will occur in the tribulation period. Okay, and I think he gravitates towards that, and I certainly respect his view on that. But when that happens in the campaign of Armageddon, this is the Lord returning. Jesus is returning, and he's dealing with the Antichrist single-handedly. He's fighting them off. Okay, what I point out is that the Israeli Defense Forces today are instrumental. They're the tool the Lord uses to fight off the Psalm 83 Arabs. And I show scriptures like Ezekiel 25:14, dealing with Edom. I will execute vengeance by the hand of my people Israel, not by the Messiah, by the hand of my people Israel on Edom, and they shall know my fury and vengeance. Obadiah 1:18 is a very important prophecy. The house of Jacob will be a fire. The house of Joseph a flame, but the house of Esau shall be stubble. Esau is the father of the Edomites. The Edomites have the tents of Edom in this prophecy. So the thing, and even Asaph petitions the Lord in verses 9 through 11, to deal with this confederacy in the manner of historical Jewish military precedent. At the time of Gideon, when he defeated the Midianites, the Lord empowered Gideon to defeat the Midianites. 300 men kill 120,000 Midianites. He also talks about deal with them like Barak, the general, did at the time of the Canaanites, and the Israelites won, they were empowered. So he's petitioning the Lord to deal with them, empower the Israeli Defense Forces, to the matter of historical precedent, as was done.